Welcome to the AI in Academia Navigating the Future podcast. This podcast will feature a range of guests who will share their insight on AI around impact, risks, and opportunities in academia. Our goal is to prepare our higher ed audience to embrace responsible uses of AI in teaching, learning, academic research, and administration.
I am one of your co-hosts, Noah Chansarkisa, a associate professor of mathematical sciences at Bentley University.
And I'm your other co-host, Gaurav Shah, the director for academic technologies at Bentley University. And today we are welcoming our guest, Monica Garfield, who is a professor and chair for the Computer Information Systems Department here at Bentley. Monica, I've known for a long time while I was teaching in the same department as well. So she has been my boss, so to speak. Monica teaches databases, strategic information systems, where she talks about data-driven decision-making. And her research focuses on the use of IT to enhance team formation, cross-cultural work, digital transformation, and knowledge creation, specifically in the healthcare industry. Her current work aims to use data and IT to improve society and reduce homelessness. And most recently, which is why we love to have Monica on our podcast, she played an instrumental role in launching Bentley's first AI major for our undergraduate student population. So welcome to our podcast,
Great.
Monica.
Thank you. It's always good to be here. Love talking AI with folks.
Great.
So you say I just started the AI. My undergrad's actually in cognitive science. So that was the precursor to AI. So psychology, physio-psych, computer science, linguistics. Thinking back in the 80s that we were right there. We were just about to get the next ChatGPT.
Uh-huh.
Took about 40 years. But here we are.
So having seen waves of hype cycles, how do you know that it's different? I mean, I think we all kind of feel it, but how do we know for sure that this is different and it won't, you know, fade out?
Yeah. I don't know if we ever know anything for sure. So I wouldn't say that. But I would say that it's been an evolutionary situation. So I don't see this as, oh, my God, we now have AI. But in fact, it's been something that we've been working on and growing for a long time. The big change is computing power. We now can actually run the algorithms. We also have far more data to work with, especially individual data that we find, you know, Web 4.0, 5.0, whatever we want to call that now. So we're able to bring in human data at a different level than we used to be able to.
That's right. And that really does seem to be the game changers, compute plus data.
Absolutely.
Now, a lot of those models we had in the 80s are bearing fruit.
Exactly. But probably not in Lisp.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. 10 years from now, who knows?
Exactly.
So, Gaurav, do you want to start with our line of questioning?
Yeah, let's start with the teaching areas where, you know, CIS department teaching courses in programming. You know, I know a list of programming courses. And one of the areas of impact is of AI is around learning how to code and how you can use AI for making codes efficiently. Can you talk a little bit about the impact of AI in the courses that are being offered here at Bentley and for other schools?
Absolutely. We're in the early stages, right? It really has taken off and had an impact in the last probably year or so. And we're starting to learn how to incorporate it the best way we can. Part of the problem, of course, is it radically changes how to teach. And it's unclear to us at this point in time if knowing how to do programming at the detailed level is going to be a skill that's required for our workforce in the future, right? Do they really need to know, you know, did I put the semicolon in the right place?
Yeah.
However, being able to think in an algorithmic form. So, you know, what exactly I want this to do, how I'm going to break down these problems is what's going to be critical. So it's the critical thinking component of it. And then the part that I think we're really struggling with in the classroom is how much to introduce AI to, you know, augment the human's capability to program, and how much we say, let's first get the basics down so that when you use AI, you can tell, is this code right? Can I, you know, troubleshoot it and find the bugs and so forth? And we're still trying to learn where we go there, you know, how much of that fundamental stuff we really need to go into.
Do you think the industry might bifurcate into coders who really can code organically by hand and those who just know how to do it with Copilot and the kind of automated AI?
Oh, approach? I think we're already there.
Really?
You know, Ruby with Rails. I always get Ruby wrong. We've had this going on for a long time, right? So there's a lot of low code, no code environments. Mm-hmm. So the question is, will the group that does hardcore programming diminish further? Mm-hmm. I suspect it will. I don't know. And we'll always need top-notch programmers, but their skill isn't necessarily how to program, but how to think logically about breaking down a problem.
Yeah.
So it's a very different way than writing an essay. You have to start thinking about things in loops and in chunks, and how do I break this apart so I can do reusability and stuff like that. So I do think the hardcore programming will probably shrink.
Yeah.
But having the fundamental understanding of how it works is going to be critical.
I always think in these cases, to my experience as a math teacher, where calculators came along and we're trying to figure out what to do.
Exactly.
And the answer is, it's kind of more clear there because AI is, you know, more sophisticated. But in the math room, the calculator computes. It calculates. That's its job. And the mathematician thinks. And so much of what we do is learn how to think. And I think it's great to hear that that's what you're finding in computer science as well.
Yeah.
The mindset is what's so valuable. The way you think, the way you analyze a problem, your approach to it. The mechanics is what's more transient, mercurial, changes with time. But the mindset has not changed probably in
absolutely.
Decades.
So I talk about this a lot when people are saying, oh, you know, we just don't allow people to use ChatGPT. Or they say, well, then did you not allow them to use calculators? Should we still be using slide rules?
Coding in assembly.
Right, exactly. So it's here to stay. And the question is, how do we embrace it and utilize it to offload some of the stuff that a computer is better than we are?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I used to teach the HTML and CSS course here. And the first thing after ChatGPT came out, I asked it to put together an HTML page, which is what we teach first or the second day of class. And I'm like, wow, this is pretty cool, right? So talk about the shift that faculty have to make, especially at a business university where we are not teaching pure programming specific, you know, stuff. So how does a business university and the faculty have to change how we teach these kind of courses?
Yeah, so this has been on my mind a lot. I'm a department chair, which means I need to evaluate my faculty. I have to figure out what's the best use of their time. How do I think about their career path?
Mm.
And in the past, we've been very heavy on research. And our teaching, even though it is always quite a lot of time, this is going to be a paradigmatic shift in the way we teach.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to see a huge amount of time and cognitive power from faculty having to rethink what they always thought they had been able to teach. So I think it's going to be a little longer than I'd like to see, because most of what we're teaching now will probably be modified. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean like we update a few slide decks. I mean, we stop teaching some things and start teaching other things.
Yeah.
So we've got to get upskilled in prompt engineering. All of our faculty have to. We've got to teach faculty.
Let me push you on that a bit, because I personally find prompt engineering so fickle. Like, it depends so much on the particular software product. And it kind of gets under my skin as a professor. It feels like a trade school to say, I'm going to teach you how to prompt engineer this particular product by Microsoft. Like, I'm not teaching them how to use software. I want to teach them concepts.
Yep.
Do you believe there are those deeper concepts to prompt engineering, or it's just this particular program, people figure out these gimmicky ways to talk to it?
That's a great point. So I started to think about data-driven decision-making a long time ago and thought about that first step. What is that first step? And we have tools like fishbone diagrams and things like that that help us break it down. I'm not pleased with they're not great. So I think with prompt engineering, the first step is, how do we think about a problem and break it down in such a way that another person or computer, it can help you understand the answer.
So maybe to kind of translate a bit, it seems like less you're learning how to prompt a specific piece of software like Bard or ChatGPT.
Right.
And more, how do I think about solving problems via creating prompts? And the specific prompts you use might depend on the software, but it's more like you're thinking about how to get into a prompting mentality.
Oh, absolutely.
I think that makes a lot of sense.
I don't think we want to be teaching to a particular. I mean, that's never a good idea, right? Because you go off into industry and who knows what they're using. So that's never a good idea.
But sometimes the students are hungry for that, right? They They want the immediate software that's popular now.
Yeah.
They think that's what we're trying to provide. And it's so we have to kind of push back and say, no, you want the stuff that'll keep you employed 10 years from now, not 2 months from now.
Oh, absolutely, right?
But I like this prompting mindset that we're going to figure out how to solve problems by prompting rather than focus on the detail, you know, what words happen to work well with this version of the software.
Right. You know, and I think a big part of it is figuring out how big or small of a prompt you have. What I mean is, how do we chunk up ideas? So I start with, how do I write a program to roll dice? Or is that really not what we want? Is it, how do I have a random number generator for any kind of numbers? So dice would be example of that. And how do we think about creating those things that can be reused and are done in a small enough chunk and apply to more than one thing? And I think that's where we'll get the efficiency.
Interesting. So think about modules and architecture.
Yeah.
Coding.
Yeah. So while we're on the teaching and learning path, then I want to move us a little bit towards the AI major. So can you talk a little bit about what transpired into the AI major? What are some of your thoughts on that?
And we did have your co-conspirator, Axel Seaman, talking on the philosophy side, so now we get to hear the computer science.
So Axel and I probably started here at Bentley around the same time, so we've known each other for a long time. And he was very interested in AI, so was I. And we decided, let's do something about it. And the big thing with AI is there's two real different sides. One is, how do I actually write the algorithms, the computer code, develop the product? And the other is, how do I use the product? How is it going to impact marketing? How is it going to impact society, philosophy, the way we interact with one another, the jobs? So as we looked at this, we decided we wanted to break it down into some conceptual areas. So those were the data side of it. So that's mostly our math department. Mm-hmm. The tech side, that is mostly the CIS department. The business side, which just about anybody in business could do it. But right now we have sort of a entry level, what is AI in business in general? We have some marketing stuff in there. We have some security stuff, probably have to beef that up. And then we have the human side, however you want to call that. And that has our sociology, our psychology, our global studies. Oh, and philosophy, of course. So the idea here was to make somebody holistic in their understanding of AI. So we're not trying to compete against an MIT of the world, having people that are, you know, very mathematically inclined, but people that understand it, have those capabilities, but also understand the impact.
What kind of jobs do you envision your graduates entering?
So there's a lot of different areas. These would be people that'd be systems analysts, program analysts. They may be people that go in and do consulting to advise on the use of AI. They might be public policy folks that are helping governments or regulatory bodies on thinking about how AI would impact not only society, but maybe local businesses, how we're going to use it. I suspect some will actually go into education to be looking at how high schools, colleges can embrace AI and still make sure that we're developing a good product, meaning knowledge-based learning.
That's interesting that there is a lot, there's some movement towards specialization, you know, extreme specialization where you really want to get very technical, really be the master of this one skill, and you're kind of going the opposite. Let's really zoom out and educate people to have a broad view of the whole landscape. I think that's really valuable and overlooked in many cases. As you're saying, if you're at Microsoft, they have enough people, they might want the expert in Python for such and such. But if you're talking to a congressional staffer, they need to know the whole picture. You know, what is AI doing? How's it impacting families and teachers and, you know, the workforce and everything?
Right.
And it's hard to find that kind of expertise. Right. So it makes sense to educate a work body.
We suspect a lot of people will double major. So they'll do AI and sustainability, and they'll go into using AI for climate change. Mm-hmm. They'll do AI in healthcare and look at it in terms of medical errors and reducing that. AI in finance and get into fintech and working those areas. So we see it as really a broad area that these students can go into.
So one thing I'm wondering, as you embarked on this journey and are continue to do so, is I can see the need that this is such an important, timely, popular topic. There's student demand, there's industry demand. So I can see saying, we got to build this major fast and get it out there. You know, it's needed. On the other hand, as you're saying earlier in this episode, there's so much uncertainty about AI as a field. So how do you kind of grapple with that tension that we have to offer the students a major that signifies a certain body of knowledge, but we don't really know what's going to be in there? We don't know what the jobs will be like. Are you kind of open with the students that we're going to prepare you as best we can to a very rapidly changing field? Do you try to kind of say, like, we think these are the fundamentals that'll last for 20 years? So how do you deal with the uncertainty?
Yeah, so there's really two parts of that that we've been attacking. One is that AI is new, broad, and many people define it in different ways. So the first question is, how do we get all the faculty from 8 different departments on the same page? How do we ensure that if you're sitting in a math class or sitting in a sociology class and they talk about AI, what they're talking about? So that's going to be our first step. We need to start finding ways to have some fundamental base. Gaurav and I are looking at different ways of doing this. Then the other part is to make sure that you create a major that's flexible. So what we've done is we, like I've said, we have the 4 buckets, but we're not prescribing what you have to take in them. There's a few required. Okay. I mean, they need some required classes. But then we've talked to all the department chairs. So we've talked to every department chair, said, we would love for you to create a class. You might not have it now. It might be something that's coming up. But whenever you do, let us know so that we can add it in. So we're always growing. And as those things grow, we may have to reconceptualize current classes.
And it looks like this new major, especially the 4 years you talked about, I think gives Bentley students a unique opportunity, because as we are all thinking about jobs that will be gone over the next few years, it's the hardcore programming coding courses that are jobs that might have a shift. Whereas what you are saying, Noah, where you have the holistic view of everything, and that's what our major is giving. So we really are in that unique opportunity. And with our arts and sciences, you know, strength and our business strength can really bring our students together. Yeah, that's a great idea. Yeah.
I think that's an important lesson for our listeners outside of the Bentley community that, you know, we're not all MITs, as Monica said, but every institution has its own special recipe. It's, you know, what it does well, what it stands out for. And I think there is a lot of value in leaning into your own area of expertise and recognizing what your students are. So I think we are known for having students that are very good at communicating, working together, giving great presentations. We don't have the best reputation for like rigorous, hardcore technical expertise. We're not bad at it, but there are others that are better. Mm-hmm. So recognizing what we do, I think, has enabled us to succeed in crafting these majors. And I think others need to think about this. It's very hard to compete if you try to mimic what others do. But if you can really figure out what's in your DNA that makes you special, AI is so huge, there is opportunity to come up with any program, as you have done here at Bentley.
Yeah. What I would add to that is, although you say maybe we don't have depth in certain areas, we have students that have the capability to have depth in certain areas. Mm-hmm. So while we might be not be an MIT, I might be nurturing a student that is looking to go into hardcore tech, and they will couple it with a CIS major, right? Or somebody who is very strong in their mathematical thinking and couple it with a math major. So we can still develop students who will be able to compete at various levels of depth. But we also have students who are going to want to be more holistic in nature, and they might couple it with health sciences or sociology. And it just gives them an opportunity to find where they fit. Yeah.
That's a great clarification. I'm glad you pushed me on that, that it's really we're looking at what's the program and the institution that we want to push students through. But within that group of students, there's so much variability, and individual students are capable of anything at any institution.
That's right. Yeah.
But we can still design our program so that, you know, en masse, this is how students are going to be educated and performed. But there'll be individual deviations where people can say, hey, I want to do that program, but I want to go really hard into this direction. And we can enable that. Yeah. Thanks for clarifying.
Absolutely.
And what do you think? Is Bentley prepared to provide the support around this? And then I ask this because many institutions probably need the right infrastructure if we want to go all in, or at least some flavor of AI. What do you think we need to have in place, and or what are the gaps right now to bring us up to speed on this?
Sure. So this is a very unique major, particularly in, well, not particularly at Bentley, but we're cross college. So that means we arts and sciences and business. Very unusual for most universities. It's very hard for us to work on these. Mm-hmm. So we do see that there's going to be some gaps. Again, the biggest gap is making sure that we all have the same baseline understanding of AI. And that is tricky. I'm hoping that we can figure that out by, you know, doing different readings and different ways of getting them together. Having faculty the way faculty are, many of them are going to have their own strong beliefs and see that as the way to see the world.
Yeah,
we're hoping we can overcome that. So that's one part. The other thing that we're still grappling with is how do we ensure since we do give our students a lot of leeway in what they're going to take. So they may be 4 required and then they can take another 5. How do we ensure that they all come out of the program with the same or similar ideas of AI? So I think we're going to really have to push on a capstone class.
Yeah.
And that is going to be a challenge because I think when you get into an interdisciplinary nature of AI, who teaches that class? Mm-hmm. I believe you're going to have at least 2, if not 3 people in the classroom. Yeah. That is a financial model that is challenging for universities. I don't know if we'll be able to get there. The other option is to go with sort of a capstone thesis. Okay, well, now if your AI blows up and you have 100 students, now I'm going to have 100 different theses and 100 different people. That's not quite right. So that's going to be a part that I see as a challenge for us in the next few years.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What about infrastructure?
So you're talking technical?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. You know, that's changing so rapidly. And that's going to be a big problem. So I'm dealing with it in 2 aspects of infrastructure. I have faculty that do research in this area.
Yeah.
You know, so they need fast computers, GPUs, cycle times. And our budgets at universities tend to be capital budgets. Mm-hmm. So if I buy something today, it's going to likely not be useful in 2 years.
Yeah.
But I may not have the budget in 2 years if I go with something that is a monthly base. So
it's a use case we are grappling with right now.
Absolutely. So that's a huge problem with universities don't think about these monthly costs.
No.
Not in terms of technologies like this. So I think that's going to be a problem. I think there's going to be a shift in what is considered a course cost. Typically, the course costs are around textbooks. And now I think it's going to be around
tools and
do we go with it at a university level so all students have access? Or do we go it on a class-based, individual-based? Uh-huh. So to me, infrastructure is really a financial issue on how are we going to price this out, make sure that we're not purchasing something that's unuseful in another 6 months. And that's a real problem in AI.
Yeah. So I want to segue now because you brought it up perfectly at the right time is AI and scholarship in research. And you touched upon a little bit around that on the use of infrastructure. Talk a little bit more about how AI is helping faculty in your department specifically in helping enhance or speed up research or other ways?
Sure. So there's a couple, again, I'll break it down to a couple areas. So one is using AI to do research and one is doing research about AI.
Yeah.
So I'll talk first about using AI to do research. So there's a couple good online programs that I've sent some faculty to that really help you develop analytical models using prompting, right? So now, even though the individuals I sent are ones that already write their own Python scripts, their own models, this will speed it up for them.
Yeah.
They won't have to do all of the coding themselves. They won't have to do all the troubleshooting, but they have the mindset of what is it that I'm going to ask? And can I look at the model that comes out and validate it? So it speeds up the development of that model, but you still need the expertise to be able to understand it. Mm-hmm. But I am seeing people do that.
Have you come across, I've heard just on social media, I don't know how reliable it is, issues of degradation that sometimes ChatGPT is really good at assisting with coding and then somehow over time it starts introducing errors and its performance flags. Do you know anything about that?
And I'm forgetting what we call that. Hallucinations,
yeah.
But even specifically performance getting worse over time.
Yeah, I haven't seen that.
Okay.
So my work is more qualitative. And what we did was we used ChatGPT along with a couple different APIs so that it can read in our interview transcripts.
Qualitative data.
Data and code it for us.
I see.
So we started to do that and we got a lot of hallucinations. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was, we'd say, give us, you know, 3 quotes about that. And the quotes weren't in our data.
Wow.
So every time it came, I had to go search through my data and validate. And then that makes you think, hold on, if you're making up the quotes, what's the likelihood that the theme is right? Yeah. So we've been working on that with a consultant who does AI down in Texas for 8 months now. And what we've decided that we really have to do, because AI is so new at, especially qualitative coding, we have a human doing it and we have the AI doing it. And we'll start comparing those. Now, granted, that's going to be somewhat dependent on the AI you use. We're using ChatGPT. We had tried Bard. It didn't work as well. Atlas TI also helped us quite a bit. So that did our base categories. So I can see that it could speed up qualitative coding, that it could speed up quantitative coding. So for the method sections of papers is what I'm saying. I'm not clear if it will do a lot for us in lit review. I haven't found that it does a great job of connecting ideas. And we're having that problem with the qualitative. But then you have a whole slew the other side. Well, people studying AI. So what I'm finding really interesting there is the number of AI experts that pop up everywhere. And it's never clear to me who is an expert. Because it's is it a fad for you in your research? Is it something you truly understand? I'm uncertain here. So that's been interesting. IT, my department is management, computer science, information systems. So I have people doing ethics on the management side. And then I have someone who's a PhD in AI doing, you know, model development. So it's such a range. And they don't necessarily speak the same language. Certainly don't have the same research outlets.
Well, thank you. This was very helpful, Monica. We covered a lot of areas. I got to learn a lot. And so thank you for having that candid conversation with us.
It's an exciting adventure. I love talking.
AI is just so cool. And I can't wait to see the students come in and learn it from our major.
And that's so cool that you've been in it for so long, that you've seen the evolution of the field and how it's impacting the classroom and society. It must be very exciting to see.
It is. It's so much fun.
Yeah, and that's why I think we were in good hands when you put together this major too. It's your experience bringing into this, and
thanks.
And also, you know, earlier in the podcast, you talked about data and your expertise in data-driven stuff, and with big data, which was the last fad that we had. Now we finally have the technology to go through that big data, so it's exciting times to be in. So thank you again for joining us.
You're welcome. This was fabulous. Thanks, guys.
Great. Thank you.
Our guest today was Monica Garfield, professor and chair of the Computer Information Systems Department at Bentley University.
Join us as we navigate the evolving landscape of AI, offering our audience an inside look at innovative ways higher education institutions can harness this technology. Whether you're an educator, student, researcher, academic administrator, or simply an AI enthusiast, AI in Academia, Navigating the Future, promises to enlighten, challenge, and inspire. Tune in to be a part of the conversation that's shaping the future of education.